And I got out, I come running back to you. I come running back to you. Yeah, I come running back to you.
Welcome to the Wayne Bennett Podcast, celebrating West Virginia's people, places, and the culture of Southern Appalachia. Now here's your host, Wayne Bennett.
Welcome to Wayne Bennett's podcast. My name is Wayne Bennett, and this is episode 107. And today our guest is a businessman. He's a former coach, a politician, policeman, humanitarian, and a good friend, Tim Berry. Welcome, Tim.
Good morning, Wayne. Good to be here today.
Listen, let's talk a little bit about your early life. You grew up on the Hoist Road at Stanford, didn't you?
I sure did. Your old neighborhood, as a matter of fact.
Tell people what the Hoist is. I mean, how did that get that name?
Well, the Hoist Road was named after, at the end of Hoist Road, it's a dead end of sorts, and at the end was actually a hoist where they would bring coal up from the Piney Gorge, from the mines. And matter of fact, today, the big concrete base, the foundation for it is still there today. Uh-huh. That's right at the end. And that's where Hoist Road came from. It was just a big hoist that brought the coal up out of the gorge.
Well, I'd heard later that people rode the hoist to get up out of, there used to be a town or two down mm-hmm. over the hill there. But you had a pretty normal childhood. You played sports, Route 41 baseball. Did you play there?
I absolutely did. My little league was actually there on Raglan Road, right down from where the post office is now, near the intersection with Stanford Road. And it was Stanford Little League. And, we were just a normal group of kids, and that's where we played our little league ball. Once that league kind of stopped and I guess merged with Beckley Little League, I was never a part of Beckley Little League. It had merged before I got too old to play.
Now you went to the old Stanford School,
yes.
Grade school that before they tore it down. What about your family? Tell me a little bit about your family life.
Well, of course, my grandparents, of course, my parents, they've since passed. My sister Amy Lilly, she's a 40-year employee at the City National Bank on Park Avenue. She's one of the old Bank of Raleigh girls, as I call them. And then, of course, my two daughters. Carrie is my oldest, and she's still employed as a bookkeeper. Been there since her senior year in high school. She currently works for John Smith CPA. And then my youngest daughter, Amber, she works for Jan Care and has been there 15 years, and she works in running the insurance billing department for Jan Care.
Now, Amy had, I think it's when she went to Beckley College, I was running intramurals back in the early 80s or something like that, and she played in our tennis tournaments we had, and quite an athlete, actually. She's pretty good.
She played volleyball in high school and I think ran track as well. But yeah, she was a racquetball. She was just a good racquetball. She's certainly a good golfer today.
Really? Now, your dad worked for the railroad, didn't he?
37 years. He was on the CNO, and then, of course, it changed over, merged with CSX. And not too long after the merger, he had got his time in. He worked every single day that you can work before you retire.
Yeah. Were there any influences when you were growing up, any coaches or male influence or female influences that might have affected you or encouraged you that you remember?
Well, my grandfather on my dad's side, Papa Oakey, he was my mentor. He taught me about people. He taught me how it's so important to treat people the way you want to be treated. You'll never go wrong with that. And I've lived my life by that principle and it's never failed me. But he was probably my number one mentor in my life. He actually lived on the Hoist. He built a house there in 72. And of course, we all lived on the hoist as well. You know, as far as business, you know, my business was probably Gray McAllister. Now, Gray was my partner when we built the go-kart track, miniature golf, and all that. And
okay, let me stop you 1 second. Mm-hmm. We're going to get into that.
Okay.
I'm going to save Gray for a little later. But now, did your mom live over behind the Hoff Brauhaus at one time? Did I?
No.
No.
No, mom lived here off Johnstown Road on Lionel Street. We still have the house. She passed away.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. It's behind the old
Hoff Bar House. Yeah. I'm going back in history there a little bit. Yes. And we still have the house. My youngest daughter, Amber, is actually buying the house from the family, and she's going to be living there soon. She's in the process now.
Oh, okay. Now, when you were in high school, you wrestled a couple years, didn't you?
I wrestled 2 years. I wrestled for Gilbert Pennington, and Gilbert was a good guy. And, of course, I ran track. I never played baseball. That was one of the things I really wanted to do. But now, I went to work when I was 15 years old. I stocked shelves at Hill's Department Store. And I was 15 then. My dad actually had to go to Hill's and sign a paper that allowed me to go to work at 15. One of the few times my dad would ever really go out, mom handled a lot of that stuff. Uh-huh. You know, dad would go to school only to check on my homework to make sure, because, you know, I went hunting every season with the men in the family.
You graduated when, 76?
77.
77.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I taught at Woodrow during that time, but I didn't have you in class. I taught from 73 to 77. Mm-hmm. And you must have been a pretty good kid, because I never did hear much about you.
Well, to be honest, Wayne, I worked all the time. I mean, you know, we would raise our garden on the hoist was probably an acre of land where we raised our garden every year. And, you know, when daddy would go to work, if he was going to work day shift and he was going to be gone, he would leave a list of chores on the refrigerator, and mom enforced it. So Amy would have her list. I'd have my list. And unless a tornado or hurricane come through and stopped everything, that list better be fulfilled by the time daddy got home.
Now, you graduated. You got married pretty young, didn't you?
Well, you know, when I went to work for Hills, like I said, I was 15, and I was young, and of course, still wet behind the ears. And I met my wife, Mary. I met her at Hills. She ultimately ended up working there 11 years, and we started seeing each other. You know, Mary and I, we clicked from the word go, and you know, this past April made us 46 years married.
Well, congratulations!
Thank you.
And now, after you graduated from high school, did you go right into law enforcement, or was that how long after?
Well, I worked at Hills until we decided we wanted to get married. And I was 17 at that time, you know, and we got married April 10th of 77. I had been 10 days, still 2 months away from graduating. I left Hills because you couldn't work there married. So I went to work for Orkin Exterminating for a year. And all during the time, my mind was on police work. I always wanted to be a policeman from 7, 8 years old. I just always idolized the police job and wanted to be a policeman.
You became a member of the city police, and even as young as you were, though, you were kind of getting publicity. I know you used to do the radio broadcast on CIR, the traffic in Beckley.
Actually, before then, I did Out Your Way with Bill O'Brien and
Gordon Ross.
Gordon Ross, yes.
Yeah.
Gordon, Bill, and I would do the Out Your Way program at least once a month. And you know, Bill O'Brien, Bill and I just clicked from day one. You know, Bill, he told me once, and of course I was probably 19 at the time. I'd just gotten out of the academy, and you know, officers don't really care about doing these public relations things. So, you know, Tom DeRed, who was our chief at the time, he says, you know, Barry, you like to talk a lot. Why don't we put you out here and let you do a little public relations? And I said, well, okay, chief, whatever you want me to do. So he sent me down, and the first couple radio shows I did, Bill told me, he says, you know something I'm going to do for you? I said, what's that? He said, I'm going to teach you how to talk radio. And that's where I learned how to inflect my voice. Bill O'Brien taught me how to talk on the radio. And it was like, it would go from like, well, this is Tim Berry from the Beckley City Police Department, to this is Tim Berry talking to you with WJLS in Beckley, West Virginia. And that was all, I learned all of that from Bill O'Brien.
Wow. Now, of course, being a policeman, it wasn't all positive as far as your notoriety. I remember on the front page of newspaper one time, you tore down these kids' skateboard ramp. Do you remember?
I did. And you know, I really hated to do that. And you know, I discussed that with Harry Perkowski, who was my sergeant at the time.
I graduated with Harry.
Yeah. And you know, Harry, we all love kids. And even though I was a kid myself, you know, I had, of course, you know, I had my oldest daughter, Carrie, and I understood a little bit about being a parent. But you know, the problem with that one was I didn't really have a lot of choice because the administration at the time, which was John Howard, I'm thinking it was John Howard. If it wasn't, it was Chuck Schumacher. I can't remember now. But they said that it was on the street and you couldn't have something like that on a public street or highway. And I really didn't care for that to tear it down. But it was kind of like, well, you know, you're the officer. It's your job to enforce the codes as they're written. So I had to move the kids on, and I did to take it down. It wasn't a sledgehammer thing. We just kind of moved it out of the way.
Yeah,
did.
I think it was barely standing anyway.
It was pretty rickety, yeah. It may be a little unsafe, but you know, the kids were having a good time. And nobody did get hurt.
Well, how many years were you on the police force?
15.
You got into coaching. Let's talk about the coaching a little bit. You were coaching Little League softball, and I don't know. I know you coached some all-star teams, and did both your daughters play softball?
Just Amber. Carrie never really expressed it. She played a little volleyball in elementary school, but she kind of lost interest in it. She wasn't the athletic type. She was more the book wasn't a bookworm, but she paid more attention to her schoolwork, and I think she also liked to hanging out with her friends, stuff like that. So athletically, she wasn't very much inclined, but Amber was.
But now you started the Beckley Babes organization,
yes,
group, which was probably the first girls travel team around.
It was.
And that involved a lot. I mean, fundraising, that involved a lot of travel. And I mean, getting competitive, you know, being competitive. And you also were involved with being on the committee of when Woodrow Wilson built the softball field out there. And that was new stuff. But you had a couple guys, I know. You've had a lot of people to help you along the line, but I know a couple of guys I remember, Tim Curtis somewhere, he helped you a lot. Roger Sloan later.
Absolutely.
At the college helped you. Mm-hmm. So you were also coaching volleyball. And is there any place you didn't coach volleyball?
I was at Stanford Elementary in the beginning. And I was like everybody else, you know, I was a volunteer parent and I just wanted to help the team however way I could. And I, you know, as the years went by, I kind of studied the game and learned a little bit about it. And one of the first things I learned was, you know, when they're in elementary school, you focus on having fun and, you know, don't try to throw too much on the young kids. Make sure they have fun. A kid that's having fun is going to learn more. And is going to be more open to learning things. So that was one of the focuses. And, you know, Sue Rakes was actually the elementary coach at the time. And she taught there as well. And Sue had this ability to charm these kids. And the girls just loved her. And they would go out and they'd do extra. If Sue would ask them to learn something new, like one of the first things that they learned, apart from just passing the ball, is they learned how to jump. They still weren't much on attacking the ball or spiking the ball. They learned to jump a little bit. So as they get older, you start putting things will start coming together. And by the time they get to high school, they should really have decent skills. But I learned a lot too. probably 5, 6, 7 year range, even in softball and volleyball, that, you know, our kids weren't getting to college on scholarship. And at that time, you know, there was a lot of money out there for girls, thanks, of course, to Title IX. And, you know, I sat down, matter of fact, with Roger Sloan, Wayne Moore, Tim Curtis, Jimmy Peterson, Paul Gutz. We all just, and we decided, well, why don't we, and this was softball, of course, at the time, we decided to put some teams together and coach and travel these kids and get them some looks, you know? So having done that, one of the biggest problems that you run across, especially in softball, in the upper level especially, is, you know, you've got to have your chops. You've got to have technical knowledge and abilities as far as to coach and teach what you're coaching. So we all actually attended ASA, Amateur Softball Association. We attended ASA coaches clinics, and we all became certified ASA softball coaches. We went, I think it was like 3 different years, and you'd step up each grade. And you not only learned how to coach a little bit, you learned how to coach your own kids. You learned techniques and drills. And this helped us to convey that to our kids. Yeah. Because the thing in travel ball is that is expensive. And if you're going to be in travel ball, you got to realize, and your parents know it up front, you got motel, you got food, you got gas, you have a lot of it, and your time. We traveled 8 to 10 weekends a summer. And, you know, when you work for a living, you know, you might work through the week, and then there's your weekends on the road.
Yeah.
Makes it tough on the working family. Yeah. But, you know, we had a lot of success. We raised a lot of money. And it cost a lot of money. We raised money to buy uniforms, equipment, and things like that. You know, we ran 4 teams, 12, 14, 16s, and 18s. And, we tried to raise around $10,000 per team. And that was each team had that goal. And they did their fundraisers. We coordinated it and helped them any way that we could. But now we did a lot of them together too.
Now, you were doing volleyball also. You were, mm-hmm. besides Staniford, you went to Stratton, mm-hmm. Park, Shady Spring.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the MSU. Well, CWV at the time.
You started the softball and the volleyball program at the College of West Virginia.
Well, I started the softball program. The volleyball program was the first women's program. Okay. And, Joanne Ross, she was coaching when I was at Shady, and they had asked me if I would consider taking volleyball on as well as softball. I started the softball program in 96. And I tell you, that was a team effort. You know, I mean, when we actually built the softball field at Woodrow, I mean, good Lord, the business people that stepped up, you know, Modley's Plumbing took care of the plumbing. Ernie Hinkle, remember Ernie?
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, God love Ernie, and may he rest in peace. Ernie took care of all the electrical. He did the electrical for us free. And Racine Thompson, who was an assistant superintendent at the time, he saw that we had what he could provide from maintenance. You know, the sewer, water, and of course, and he actually even run getting power to the field itself. And then Ernie would go from there, because, you know, Ernie was a master electrician. The vocational school did a lot of the block work. It was hard to do the block work. I had to bring in a couple of friends, and one of them was Norman Underwood, which, you know, he was from Mount Pineview Way, and he actually his crews laid the block, yeah. on the concession building.
Well, then you turned around and renovated the old Warren Williams field.
Yeah, it seems like that's all I did for 10 years was field. Was
that field was had been used for years in baseball and softball, mm-hmm. and men's softball, and then it just kind of lay dormant, used mainly for practice fields for Beckley Junior High and Park football.
Prep rallies.
Pep rallies, and it became the Dust Bowl, mainly dust and glass and whatever else was down there. I coached for 13 years, and we practiced down there every day, and the August was tough. I mean, and I'm still paying for it. The dust that I breathe and the sun on my ears, and it's – but you took over, and when you took over the volleyball and softball program at College of West Virginia and renovated that field, and that took thousands of dollars, I'm sure. But that now it's used mainly as a baseball field for
and Greater Beckley owns Greater the Beckley. Property now. They actually own that, yes, which is a story in itself. But when we moved in there, you know, I remember walking down the first acres, and all we had was the foundation where the concession building sits. And then you look out over, and it was just, oh, it was like a big desert, you know how it was. So first thing we had to do was, I was like, you, I knew what was in that, on that infield. It was, and they, you wouldn't believe some things we brought out of there. So I engaged the city, and the city came in, and they, thanks to Mr. Robinson, he sent a backhoe and a truck. And two trucks, actually, because he would load one and we'd load one while the other one was taking it to wherever you put their fill. We dug down probably 16 inches in the infield, and we cut it out. And then once we got everything out of there, we pulled door frames, I don't know how many screws, bolts, glass, but we dug it down 16 inches in the shape of the infield. We got our measurements, you know, from schematics, and got it all hauled out of there. And then we put a base down, it was stone, I forget how much stone. And then we put sand down. We topped it off with red clay, which Racing Thompson made arrangements for us to have clay. And there was a lot of clay when in the beginning. And we had to hump it up so that it would settle to a level. And then we had no grass in the outfield. So we brought in, I forget how many truckloads of topsoil that came from, you know, the Shell station or the Texaco station out in Grandview, J.K. Allen. J.K. Allen donated all the topsoil because they was getting ready to start construction on that. And all that had to come out of there anyway.
Yeah.
So Mr. Robinson, again, with the city, he sent dump trucks out. They loaded him while they skimmed all that topsoil off. And we got every bit of it. Wow. And I don't know, it was like 100 truckloads of topsoil. They brought it out and they dumped it all around the whole outfield. And once it was all put down, we had a guy with a backhoe or a dozer, and he smoothed it out pretty much. And then I went to the jail, and I had like 10 inmates a day for a month. And they raked it and picked all the rocks out of it and smoothed it over. And then they, at the very last, it settled a little because we had a couple rains, you know. And they smoothed it out. They soldered it. They put the seed down. And then they rolled it, and we put straw over it. I think that's how it went. And then we just let it set. Just left it alone. And it took a couple years for it to get workable because we had some little holes here and there. But we tried to, and we had a pile of topsoil that we could use to fill when we needed it. But that's a 2-year project.
You turned it into quite a facility, and you but it enabled you to have clinics, to have tournaments, mm-hmm. and games, and those kind of things. And of course, you in your coaching volleyball and softball, you've won several awards, Coach of Year awards, mm-hmm. and those kind of things. You even got a squeeze of the water bottle from Wayne Bennett's wrestling column one time.
I sure did.
And, maybe two of them. I'm not sure. But
probably laying around here. It's probably laying around here somewhere. I got a lot of my stuff here.
But you resigned the MS. It became Mountain State University. You resigned in 2009, both of them. And hindsight, that was a good move for you the time.
I'm going to be honest with you, Wayne. You know, I was councilman at large at the time with the city, which I served 21 years on the city council. In 2009, my goal was to be there 7 or 8 years in 1996. That was my goal. Get it up and running and then move on. You know, because I'd retired from police department and I had other things I really wanted to do. But the girls, They grow on you, and they make it hard to leave. So I stayed. In 09, that was when the grumblings were starting about there were problems at MSU. Uh-huh. And on city council, I had access to information, conversations with people that basically, you know, I had people come to me and say, look, I'm just going to tell you right that MSU is not going to be open much longer. And of course, whoever they wanted to blame was whoever they wanted to blame. But I saw that coming. So I got my opportunity. I'd recruited my team for the next year. I had already made for volleyball. So I left and I finished that spring knowing that the softball wasn't going to be back in the fall. And I had recruited the volleyball team, had a good volleyball team, had a lot of talent. And then after the softball season, I left them with a good team, good schedule on volleyball, and then of course the softball, they took care of it.
Now let's talk about Tim Berry, the businessman. One of the early businesses that you had, Body Bronze, you and Brian Blake.
Sure did. BB and I.
Where was that at? That was Tanning Bed.
Yeah, it was actually up here on Johnstown Road in Serendipity Square. It burned down here a few years ago, and that belonged to Gray McAllister. BB and I had been looking and we just put trying to figure out something to do because we want to do something besides work all the time. And having a business, although you do work all the time, we want something that would be a nice little something to do that might supplement, you know, your income some. And that's how it came up. We actually bought Body Bronze from Brian Stone and, he gives a real good deal on it and it took off. I mean, and of course it was very popular at the time. We were making, it was $50 for 10 sessions and that at that time. And we were packed all the time. It went that way for a couple, 3 years.
And then the tanning thing kind of got.
Everybody went into the business.
Yeah.
And we actually had bought two other tanning salons out basically just to put them out of business. We bought the Ramada when Larry Stover was up there and, Larry didn't want to fool with that anymore because I think he saw it happening too. And, we bought him out and poor Brian, he's single, never been married. We had his living room packed and stacked with tanning beds. I don't know. We had like 15 at one time and he could take them apart and put them back together. I mean, it was he was very good at it. And, we did that for several years and, my mom actually took it over when I decided to go in with Mac on Raglan Road.
Now, you had, before that, you had kind of an alarm, burglar alarm thing.
That was short.
Yeah, yeah.
That was I kind of liked the concept of it, but, you know, home security, and basically what they were personal alarms. You pull the pin, attach them to your purse. Somebody snatch your purse, they pull the pin, and it makes this ear purse, those type things. And they had a couple little units for the home that worked on air pressure. But that was kind of short-lived. I don't know. I like the concept, and I think that the policeman, you know, in me thought that was pretty good little deal. But as I got into it, I kind of lost interest in it. I wanted to do something a little more involved with the public.
Now, you also had a beauty salon, didn't you?
I rented a space in Serendipity. He had it open, and it was a beauty shop already set up. And a lady had, if memory serves, she'd fallen ill. And I had no knowledge of it at all. But I rented it, and I rented it out. I rented stations out. And I kept that for maybe a year, and it was okay. Then I sold it.
Then you got hooked up with Gray McAllister, and he'd done well in the contracting business.
Yes.
And what old businesses did you two guys get in together?
Well, you know, Mac and I, it's so weird how the whole thing happened. Of course, you know, I rented from Mac with the tanning salon and then the beauty shop when it happened. And we were up having lunch one day in Nanashaw, And Matt kind of looked at me and says, you know, it's a shame that this area just doesn't have anything for these kids. And I said, well, I agree, Mac. I mean, I've thought about that a long time. And he said, you remember down at the bottom of Raleigh Hill when they had the go-kart track there next to Boggs? And I said, well, I was a real little feller then, but yeah, I do remember it being there. That. Hey, you know, that would be big here, but it's an expensive venture to start with. And he said, you know, what about miniature golf? And I said, well, I think there's been one miniature golf, maybe two in back. I can't. That goes back a long ways. But anyway, we sat there over lunch and we decided, let's do a miniature golf course and maybe batting cages. Because, you know, of course, I was softball at the time. And I knew that there was a need for it. So we went out to Raglan Road and we looked at where the miniature golf and the batting cages were. We went out there one afternoon. We didn't know who owned it. And I'm trying to think, it was Zan Campbell, I think, told us that he gave us the owner's name. So we contacted him. They sold it to us. So, wow. Boy, we sat down and we contacted the company that actually did the batting cages. And they sent us specs. We give them our dimensions, what we were working on. We designed a building all ourselves. We did that ourselves. And then the miniature golf course, which was probably the most involved of it all. We designed that course ourselves. And it was like we took a piece of paper with the measurement. We measured. We scaled it because that's what I did. You know, with the city. I was a policeman. I was an accident reconstructionist. So, I mean, I could work on scale. And I sit there and do a big square. This is where the miniature golf course is going to go. This is where you enter. And then this is where you'll have to exit to go back into the building. We sit there and we literally drew 18 worms and that worked with each other where you could go off of one into another like a golf course does. And about 3 hours, we worked it out and we finally got the design where we wanted it. And the only thing we had to work from then was, of course, the elevation. And Billy Lane, which Stanfordite. Billy, we met with Billy out there after we closed on the property. Billy said, I can build it, but we'll need you there to show us how high you want your humps, where you want your curves, and all this. I can work off this to get the shape, but we need you to decide how you want us to. And we actually were out there every day. And
I'd go by there and see Norman Boggs. He was kind of the boss or something.
Norman, Jimmy, Clyde, who ran the backhoe.
Clyde James.
And, before we did, we had to lay the infrastructure for the lights. We had four 1,000 watt light fixtures on the corners, and maybe it lit it up rather well. And you know, lighting out there was imperative, especially on the batting cages.
Was that a good business venture?
It was. It was expensive. You know, I think it was $375,000 to complete the entire venture. I mean, and I'm talking batting cages, and the miniature golf and all, and the go-kart track. But now that came back, of course, the next year. The first venture was probably $110,000, maybe something like that. And
but now you
we had a super, super first year. Then at the end of the first year, we were over to batting cages, and we were looking across over National Mine Services and saw that big bottom down there. And we knew National Mine owned it, and Garrett Luther was the manager over there at the time. And Max said, what do you think about buying that down there? And I said, and I knew what he was going to say. I said, what for, Mac? He said, we could do a parking lot and a batting cage. Not a batting cage, but a go-kart track. I said, oh, Lord. And we had met an individual from the amusement convention that we had attended in Washington, D.C. that year. And we called him. And asked him, he remembered us for some reason, I guess, when you're in D.C., and he was from Canada. So he said, well, the amusement convention is coming up in, it was like 2 months. It was in Dallas, Texas. And so we'll meet you down there. So we drove down there. We took the wives and made a big vacation out of it and had a good time. And we met them at the booth. They took us out to dinner. By the time we left Dallas, We done bought 12 go-karts, two of which were those big doubles, you know, so you could take the your little ones that may be too little to ride alone. And we done bought two, and we had a plan for the go-kart track, how to build it. So when we got back, we called Billy. He just asked us, oh my God, what are y'all building now? So we met with Billy, took him down there and showed him. He said, well, we'll do it. And Norman Underwood, he did all the block work for us. Billy, of course, did the concrete and he set the posts in place around the track to put our rail. And, you know, the rail was unique, the guardrail, in that it was 8-inch heavy-duty plastic drain pipe. And we drilled it after the track was done. We went on the post and we actually take a hole saw. We wore out, I don't know, 5 or 6 hole saws, and we would drill holes all the way through one and then set them down. We'd bring the next rail in. We'd lay the bottom rail for a ways, and then we'd bring the upper rail in for a ways. Triple S Welding manufactured us a top piece that went down in the top of the pipe to keep the rail from popping out, and then tighten the inside of the pipe so it wouldn't let it come
out. Did you put the bumper boats in at the same time?
Well, we went through the first year with the go-kart track. Oh my God. Never seen. We employed like, I don't know, eight or nine kids. And we had Mike Green was his first job. He run our pit. And Mike did a great job. Oh, yeah. Jeff, and then we had Jeff Garten. They ran the pit for us. We run 7 days a week, and we were so busy. God, we were so busy. Graduation came, and that was probably one of my fondest remembrances is we had 75 couples in tuxes and gowns on the miniature golf course. And somewhere there's a picture of that. It was quite a sight to see. We were taking pictures. Of course, that back in the day, that was taken with, you took them with the old 35 millimeter. We didn't have phones then other than the bag phones, yeah. You know, the old Motorolas. But at the end of that season, it was in October or November. I can't remember which. It was one of the nicest. You know, we still got some property back here we haven't used. I thought, oh my God, Mac, what now? Because we just paid off a big chunk of what we owed, you know, to build it. I said, what in the world you got in mind? He said, well, you know, when we were down Pigeon Forge, so we went down there a lot, and we made a lot of friends down there in the go-kart business and stuff. And he said, what do you think about bumper boats? And I said, oh my God, Mac, you want us to build a pool? He said, I think we can do it. And I said, well, let's see. Let's run the numbers and see. So that cost about $75,000, something like that, or $80,000 to build, just that, because we already owned the land. The concern was, you know, it had the power line that ran over, and APCO had to sign off on it. And it says, okay. Now, they said no problem with the go-karts. And I thought they'd surely say something about the bumper boats because it was water. But we grounded it every 8 feet. It was so well. I mean, even the rebar, we grounded the rebar. I went before we poured. So we had dinner one night after doing all this, and we got Billy. And Billy Lane made a lot of money off us during those days. And Billy said, yes, I can build you a pool. I mean, that's what you're going to have. You're going to have a pool. And it's going to have to meet pool specs. You're going to have a pump filter and all 9 yards. So we, we went to construction that winter, and we built a pool. And, I mean, it was a swimming pool. I mean, it had everything. It had the ports inside the walls and the whole 9 yards. You had to chemical it, and you had to keep it up to health department standards.
Now, when did the business start going? Some reason, well, you closed.
the building. Okay, in my involvement. Now, when I left, I had just retired from the police department in '93, and I knew I had some other things I wanted to do. And I sat down with Mac because, you know, at the time I thought that Mac's family would step in and help him to do it, because, you know, Mac was 70 some years old at that time. You know, Mac was he wasn't able to. Although he was the hardest working man I think I've ever met. So I got with his grandson and his daddy, and I told him that I was looking to sell my half of it and go on to some other things I wanted to do. And this, of course, involved the city. And so we knew what the value was on it, and Mac paid me my half, and we went on. Now, I tried to stay out of it because, you know, an ex-business partner does not need to be in their business walking around doing stuff. You know, although I went out and talked to Mac a lot and stuff, Mac and our friendship were strong until the day he died. But the big problem wasn't the business. It was just he didn't have any help.
Yeah.
And when it got to that point, I don't know, it was like 3 years later, 4 years later, that's when Mac just, he just shut it down.
Yeah.
That was what he did was, and I don't think they owed anything on that doubt because he should have paid for itself.
Now, you mentioned your grandfather as having a great influence on you as, when you were younger. I have a quote from your grandfather, or a quote from you about your grandfather. And it said, my grandfather always told me, if you got to dig ditches for a living, be the best ditch digger you can be. Mm-hmm. But keep your eyes and ears open for something better, and you'll find where you need to be. And seems like you've been doing that. Now, you got into the insurance business somewhere along the line.
I did insurance and real estate at the same time. I went to Charleston and got my real estate license and thought, well, you know, insurance, which was property and casualty, is what I did. That would be a nice thing because if you sell somebody a house, you can quote them some insurance, you know. And I got my insurance license, went to work for Terry Pennington. Terry was great. She was out on Pinewood Drive at the time. But, you know, I did insurance for a year, year and a half, and along with real estate. I enjoyed real estate a lot. I love real estate. I would have done real estate 30 years ago had I known then what I know now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's.
Now, you started with Jerry Zaffirakis.
I did. Kathy was my first broker, and Jerry was who I took my class through. Yeah. And I got finished with it, and then, of course, took my state licensing exam in Charleston, and of course, passed it first time. And I sold $1.5 million in real estate my first year. And the board, of course, named me Rookie of the Year. That was one of the board awards at that time. Uh-huh. You know, and matter of fact, I think I'm the last recipient of it. Maybe I was the oldest rookie they ever gave an award to. I don't know.
Well, I sold a little bit of real estate with Jerry when he first started. Mm-hmm. And I took a class from him, and me and Frog Young, Kathy, we all started in a little old house over behind Chuck Littlejohn's bar. Mm-hmm. and then they moved down to Mabscott and then down by Kentucky Fried Chicken and then to different places. But they kept getting bigger. But I had another job, and I just did it part-time. But it's changed a lot since I first started. But you have started your own business, Tim Berry Real Estate. Mm-hmm. And you guys, how many years you been in?
2009. I took my class and I got my license in November of 2009. And I sold for 3 years, which was a requirement then. My goal when I got my license was to serve my 3 years, to get my listings and my sales together, and then apply and take the broker class. My thought all along was to become a broker and have my own real estate company. Uh-huh. And it come to pass. In 12, I took my class, and January 1st of 13, Tim Berry Real Estate opened.
Now, the business, of course, real estate now involves drones and, of course, when I was in it, the cell phones weren't even around at the time, you know. But there are some companies that are evolving out there that are kind of like internet real estate companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't mm-hmm. have offices. Right. People work out of their home, and they work for lesser commissions. Mm-hmm. Has that had an impact on the real estate business?
It hasn't. It hasn't. Myself and of course the brokers that I work with, I'm friends with here in town. You know, here's the thing. The internet is just it's there. I mean, you're not going to do anything about it. 80% of my business comes from the internet, comes from my website, comes from my Facebook. And you know, a lot of it comes back just like being positive. You know, I don't allow anything negative on my Facebook page. I don't allow politics on my Facebook page. And I spend a lot of my Facebook space, you know, being positive and to enjoy my agents. Now, in the beginning, I sold real estate. I mean, I showed houses and all that, and we did hundreds of closings. And but after I bought the building over here, I started over here. I bought that first, and then I bought this one here a few years ago. I got to the point where I didn't need to sell. I need to be a broker. And that, and my model is simple, that I want to be here. I got 15 agents. And we're all, I mean, I got agents all over the place. I mean, they sell in Mercer, they sell in Greenbrier, Fayette, Nicholas, Raleigh, you know, and Wyoming. And we even get down into, gosh, we got an agent that works at Gilbert and Hanover. He lives in Jesse. So, you know, I don't sell, I don't walk houses anymore. I don't do any of that. I get a lead, I pass it to my agents. Because, of course, if they sell, I make money. Uh-huh. And, you know, that's the thing about being a broker is anything that comes through that door belongs to me, even though I've got all these agents, you know, because I am the responsible broker. So, you know, that's when I don't get into the building as much anymore. And I don't want to compete with my agents. I don't aspire to be the top producer in my company. I am the company. So I want to support them, because the better they do, the happier they are, the more they produce, and you know, along that lines. And so I don't, every now and again, I will represent a client that only wants to deal with me personally, but I convince most of them to let me work, because my agents are great. What a super team I have.
Well, you, I think recently your company was voted number one on the readers poll from Beckley newspaper for like the third time.
Yeah, the companies have the last 2 years voted best real estate company or favorite real estate company. And then as far as me being the favorite real estate agent, the reader's choice, I've had it 4 years in a row.
Wow.
And I was shocked. I really was, because, you know, I support my agents and I work to see that they succeed. And so I'm not quite sure, but the readers look at me and they say, well, you know, I guess I'm doing my job. So, and I'm very humbled by it, because anytime that you can win one is great. I mean, but to for them to come back and give you a second or third, fourth year, that's pretty
significant. Let's talk about the Tim Berry, the politician, a little bit. You served how many years on city council?
21.
And some of those years you represented Ward 4, and then some of the years you were councilman at large. Mm-hmm. And also, you ran for county commission twice.
Was it twice? I can't. I know it was once. And
I thought you lost once to Bird White.
I lost once to Bird, and I think that was it. I ran for the Board of Education once.
Okay,
and maybe lost, that's to, what it was. Lost to. Margaret Scott and Paul Venere.
Okay. Yeah. And then you ran for House of Delegates once. Didn't you?
I did run for House of Delegates, and that was one I really shouldn't have. I did not. I don't want to serve out of my area. I want to serve Beckley. And one of the tongue in cheeks on the commission race was that Raleigh County. I ran only because I was asked to run by several people, and I really should have stayed in the city. I think I was in 07, because I had set off from council 07 to 11, and then in 11 I ran and was elected councilman at large citywide until I retired. And even in the last race, I wasn't going to run. I said I just didn't want to run. So when I did run, I didn't have my heart into this last race. I didn't campaign. And I told people called me here. They come by and they say, Tim, we need you. Run one more time. Come on, run one more time. One more time. And I'd already had a press release and an article in the paper that I wasn't going to run. I was going to retire. I'd served enough time, and it was time to, and I was really trying to convince to get younger people involved. We lose sight of that. And I actually got Cody to run. Really? And then, yeah, I got so many phone calls. People were stopping by here. Tim, I know you said you didn't want to run, but I think we need you at least one more term. And it got to the point where I said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll run, but I'm not going to campaign. I'm going to leave it up to the voters. If these voters don't know who I am by now, you know, well, but now Cody worked hard and he was out here every day campaigning. That's the way you win a race.
Yeah.
And he, I don't know, he's like, I don't know, 80 votes or something like that between us even then. So, you know, I just did not, I was so happy to retire. 21 years with the city, you know, and I was elected in 95 and I served till 07 in Ward 4. I sit out 7 to 11, then I was elected, you know, 11 until I retired. I don't know what it was, 21, something like that.
One of the things I liked about, of course, I don't live in the city, but I always pay attention. I grew up in the city and pay attention to what's going on. But one of the things I liked about you is you didn't guess what your opinion was. You told how you believed and why you believed that. And I respect that. And I wish more politicians would do that instead of straddling the fence or playing with words. But let's talk about Tim Berry, the humanitarian. I mean, you've done, besides you mentioned, we mentioned Woodrow Wilson and the field, softball field up at the College of West Virginia, but you've worked on the Improvement Council at Stratton. You've been a board member at Red Cross. You've done things to help with the Humane Society. Very active with the Blessing Box at Ebenezer Church. You've a couple big events for the police alumni. You the Rat Pack thing and the Who Done It at Black Knight, raising money for the fellow policemen. You ever go on vacation?
My wife and I, we like to go like the second week in May and the second week in October. We'll go down to Pigeon Forge. We're really just, I love Pigeon Forge and have since we started going in. I think first trip was in 75 to Pigeon Forge back when it was still two-lane road. We go down on those days because that's what they are. We always stay at the Christmas Inn in Pigeon Forge. What a wonderful place. Room 206, as a matter of fact. And we always request because it overlooks the courtyard and just a nice place. We go down on Monday and we come back. We leave Friday morning before the kids and the family start rolling in. And it has worked well for us. When we go down, we schedule dinner theater. We love dinner theater. We love dinner murder mystery theaters. We've seen all of them up on Teaster Road. Of course, the Stampede. Everybody does the Stampede. I enjoy the Majestic Theater. They put on three or four nice shows. We watch the Motown Review. We watch the 50s and 60s Review. And they come with a nice dinner, and then you can watch the show.
Is that the kind of music you listened to when you grew up? Motown?
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, and disco. As a matter of fact, if you go out of my car right now, you'll notice my radio never changes. I got Sirius at 70s on 7, and that's what I listen to. And I'm eclectic. I mean, I like some country music and all, but I don't listen to much of the new stuff because I love my disco and I can listen to it, but I would prefer. And certainly the 70s are that's my genre.
Yeah.
You know?
What do you want to be remembered as? What's your legacy? What kind of legacy do you want to leave or be remembered as?
I don't know so much about the remembering part, Wayne, as what I want people to realize is that, you know, we're all important to one another. And, you know, there's always someone that can use a leg up or need some help. And our kids especially. Our young people are being raised and they're experiencing such a different society that, of course, you know, we came up in. But I think it's important that we remember that we're all here together. We're all Americans. We all live in our little neighborhoods. And that one's no better than the other, you know, and to keep a focus and on our kids and raise them so that they can pass on maybe to their kids one day. You know, I only have one grandson and
his name is
Braden
okay.
Thompson.
Okay.
And, you know, Braden has already showed me that he's 17. He'll be 18 in December. He'll be a senior at Woodrow. Last spring, he came to us and And, you know, we started his college fund when he was born. And we had him ready to go to college. And he sat down with us last spring and said, "Papa, I want to talk to you." I said, "Oh, sure." And as a matter of fact, it was right here. And he said, "Papa, I don't think I want to go to college." I said, "Okay, well, what do you got in mind, Bray?" He said, "I want to go to Votech. And I want to learn how to be a welder. I want to be able to build things." And I said, "Well, you know, that's good." And I said, "You know, welders make about $30 an hour once you get to a certain level and stuff and with your craft." And I said, have you talked about this with your mother?" He says, "Yeah." And she says, "I need to talk to you." I don't know why, but he did. And he told me, he said, "I've already enrolled for the fall." This was, of course, last fall. I've already enrolled in ACT, and he handed me a letter that they'd accepted him into the welding program. And I said, "Well, bro, here's the way I'll address it. College is not for everybody, but learning is. Even if you're going to be a welder, you still need to be the best you can at that. And if you're going to go the ACT route, it's a good thing, because not only can you'll get 2 good years of welding, you can actually come back, take electrician, plumbing, and it not cost you anything. I think it's 22. I think you can do it up to that age, 21, 22. So anyway, he's finished his first year, and about halfway through this first year, he got a job with Joey Cox over J&J Fabricating on Ragland Road. And he goes, he worked this year. He worked after school. He would go, he'd work from 3 to 4:30, hour and a half a day. But they showed him, well, first thing, he got to Sweden, learn how to clean up and stuff. But now this summer, Joey put him on full time, and they're really impressed with his skills at such a young age. And they've got him over cutting and actually fabricating and putting together truck beds.
Wow.
And they're supervising him, of course. But now, like last night, he was a little late coming in because two or three of the guys, they had a truck bed that they had to finish. They had for a customer. So he stayed late with them and helped them finish. And he's working full time all summer. He's worked full time this summer the whole way. And Joey has already, he's bought him uniforms and jacket. He does all his laundering and everything like he does the regular employees. And he told Bray, you know, Bray graduates in May next year. And he's already told him, he said, "Bray, if you stick with me, you'll have a full-time job here with benefits, and I'll even give you a little more money, you know, when you graduate school and have your certifications and all." Mm-hmm. So that's what Bray's plan is right now. Now, he's not gone beyond that as far as anything else. But he really, he just got his driver's license this past year. He wasn't in a hurry to get his driver's license. And we got him his first truck. And we didn't know, but my dad had actually, before he passed, he had put money away for Bray to have a vehicle so he wouldn't have a car payment. And yeah, that was good. And we actually found it was a 97 Chevrolet Silverado, been totally restored, new engine, paint job, new interior. And it was a great job. And he's thrilled to death with it. And now he drives to work every day and comes home and relaxes and has to take a shower because he's dirty. You know, I don't know how the kids aren't about getting dirty these days, but in the welding job you do. But anyway, that's Bray in a nutshell.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tim, you've had a pretty eclectic life, and you reminds me of the old Frank Sinatra song, "I Did It My Way." And hopefully we'll get to talk again. I appreciate you speaking with us, and we'll do it again sometime.
Wayne, I'm available. Hopefully there we can get together. I like talking at the kitchen table. I have a lot of conversations here.
Well, we've got a lot more to talk about, so we'll get together again. I appreciate you.
Sure, anytime, Wayne. It was certainly a pleasure.
Anyone else out there that'd like to be on our podcast, you can contact me at awbennett50@gmail.com, and we'll get you on here. And remember, until then, if you're not dead yet, you're not done yet. God bless you.